From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Baltimore in 2017. Police officer Angel Villaronga responded to a call that a man was distraught, making threats, and holding a knife. He was talking about suicide or hurting somebody else. When the officer arrived, he asked the man what was wrong, and the story is recounted by journalist Zaid Jilani in an article in The Intercept. The man said, quote, "I'm not dealing with life no more, sir," end quote. And the officer spoke in calm tones, offered his own name, and said he just wanted to listen. The man insisted that the officer should shoot him. After all, he was carrying a knife and making threats. Officer Villaronga said he was doing his job, which was to talk. The man demanded to know why the officer wouldn't shoot him, and Villaronga replied, "Because we don't want to." And the officer told his colleagues across the street to stay back, give plenty of space. Then he walked closer to the man with the knife. The police body cam video shows the officer saying, quote, "Just drop it right here, man. I can talk to you. I'm 38 years old. I can relate to you, bro. There's not a thing in this world that I've not dealt with that you probably have dealt with, okay? At the end of the day, I got kids to go home to," end quote. As Jelani explains in that article, those last words did the trick, as the suspect dropped the knife and surrendered to police. The suspect was expecting a volatile confrontation. Instead, he discovered an officer with empathy. Can de-escalation work in policing? Jelani says it can, and a body of evidence indicates he's right. Scott Thompson, the former chief of police in Camden, New Jersey, told 538 in an article recently that officers dealing with protests have to work hard not to give in to their primal urges. He said, quote, "The adrenaline starts to pump, the temperature is rising, and you want to go one step higher. But what we need to know as professionals is that there are times, if we go one step higher, we are forcing them to go one step higher," end quote. And decades of research have turned up similar findings. Escalating force by police tends to lead to more violence, not less. And now more departments are looking into de-escalation training. So how does it work? Our guest this hour can explain. Joining us now is Brendan King, the CEO and founder of the Crisis Consultant Group. Brendan, welcome. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
You want to explain a little bit of your background here in Western New York? You got some roots here-ish, right?
I do, yes. I guess you could say the easiest, half of my family was from that area, and I grew up sharing time between Virginia, Maryland, and Rochester. Rachacha, I believe it was called.
See, you do know some of the lingo.
Yeah.
you're talking to us from Virginia, and that's where the Crisis Consultant Group has been based, and you've been doing this for, what, 16 years?
Yep, that's correct.
And I'm looking at your list of clients. We're going to talk primarily about what's been in the news lately. We're going to talk about how de-escalation works and primarily how that may work with policing, which I know you've got experience in. But I'm looking at your list of clients. It includes everything from, you know, police departments, sheriff's offices, to Capital One, to, you know, Presbyterian hospitals. I mean, it's a wide range. Do you have a typical profile? I mean, how are you typically working with clients these days?
Sure. So it's actually very interesting because when I started the company 15 years ago, it was truly based off of my background, specifically working at that time in mental health, or at least from my experiences early on working in mental health and with at-risk youth, where I was first exposed to de-escalation training and things that are, the industry also terms it as crisis prevention and intervention training. And later, as I eventually, and I'm sure we'll talk about, but later having some time in the Marine Corps and then in law enforcement, when I launched the company, one of our very first clients was a Fortune 500 company in the Washington, D.C. area that requested us to come in and train some of their kind of unarmed, plainclothes security folks that you know, was really a far cry from where I originally thought we would be working. And so typically, in the last few years, as you mentioned, it's ranged from, you know, organizations that do deal with youth and troubled youth or at-risk individuals and psychiatric centers, but we've had quite a bit of interest from corporate America, from hospitals, treatment centers, law enforcement, and retail, quite a few. So many different opportunities, and I think ultimately it comes down to where crisis may occur, which as you know, is pretty much everywhere.
Well, and I am curious to know right now if you're if the contacts to you have been either ramped up or more tilting in the direction of policing given the last few months in this country.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So let me read something that Jelani wrote, because the piece that I was reading from Zaid Jelani about the Baltimore officer is 3 years old now. I mean, I was also quoting from 538, a piece from a couple of weeks ago, but Jelani writing about that Baltimore situation was 3 years old, and the title of his piece was "Police Officers Should Be Trained in De-escalation. It Works." And he writes the following. From 2017, some police departments offer de-escalation training to their officers, teaching them to defuse potentially dangerous situations and get armed individuals to lay down their weapons. Most states, however, don't require such training, instead leaving the decision to local agencies. End quote. Is that still true?
I would disagree. I think, you know, even as far, I mean, verbal de-escalation for law enforcement has been around for a very long time. It is not something that is unknown. And I think the difficulty comes in is there's widespread differences of opinion in what is effective de-escalation training and what isn't. And you know, even as recent as, I believe it was 2015, where the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing talked about the action item of being de-escalation having to do with police use of force. And incorporating that into the model. So while there still may be some departments that don't maybe address this obviously as thoroughly as they need to, it is not a foreign subject to law enforcement, but there are definitely differences in the way it's delivered, the way it's taught, and surely how it's received within different organizations.
Well, and given that history then, you know, I was curious to know why... I don't want to sort of broad brush anything. I want to try to be fair and thoughtful, but why we don't see this as almost like a default. And I'll give you an example of the kind of questions our listeners may have.
Sure.
So a listener named Adam sent a note this morning after we had teased this conversation, and he wrote, "Does de-escalation include police deciding not to wear tactical gear? It seems like when they show up wearing that kind of gear, wild stuff is going to happen one way or the other," end quote. And I don't know if that's too much a generalization or if you want to start there.
Well, I think, you know, great question, but the situation, when it comes to de-escalation, one of the most important things we have to do, and especially when we consider law enforcement, my background there in tactical world, is that we have to look at what is the context and the scenario of the actual incident that we're dealing with or the situation that we're dealing with. And I think part of the difficulty with training in the past is that it was met with there were individuals that either had never worked in law enforcement or been exposed to those types of dangerous and safety, you know, risk-based scenarios, giving instructions on how to respond to potentially violent situations. And so, like, you know, when I worked in mental health, and again, going back 19 years old in a locked psychiatric hospital, I had my nose broken, I had my skull split open with a soap sock. It was a very violent environment. And in that scenario, we were only trained in verbal de-escalation and skills to try to calm, you know, mentally ill patients down, as well as physical intervention techniques that were meant and designed to be very safe and not injure the individual. Well, in that environment, you could say there were a number of factors there that were controlled. While these situations were out of control, there was very little likelihood of, let's just say, for example, a gun being inside the facility, right? That's just, it's a locked facility, people are searched. So you can control and identify that while, you know, patients may have gotten hold of weapons from time to time, like improvised things that they would put together, there were controls around that scenario where the time of when the event was occurring, how many people we had on hand to come help. And again, the weapon idea, the level of training and staff that you could pull to the scene if needed. So whether there was a therapist or a caseworker, in addition to the frontline staff, you had a lot of extra pieces of the puzzle that you could pull into to try to deal with the scenario. In regards to the question, if we're simply saying, well, we have a riot where we are in a scenario where we have all of these uncontrollable potential situations, as we've seen, whether people are shooting or weapons or throwing Molotov cocktails, or it's a little bit unreasonable to say that we're going to go in with no gear, preparing ourselves from a safety perspective for the worst behavior that arises. But as you've seen, and I know a lot of us that have followed the news, there have been events where law enforcement has shown up and they have staged the gear where they have individuals ready to respond at that level of force if necessary, but it's began with the potential of trying to create conversation and having general back and forth with the people that are there in protest. So it definitely depends on the context and scenario.
Yeah, I take that point, and I want to be careful and sort of not overplaying anecdotes, but a lot of people saw the video of a white sheriff in Michigan who, really in that cluster of days when the demonstrations, maybe a week after George Floyd was killed.
Sure.
So the sheriff comes up to demonstrators and says, "I'm putting my shield down. I'm putting my gear down. Right. I want to walk with you. I want to talk with you." And it was a powerful moment. The crowd around him cheers. And then he just walks with them. And
sure,
we could oversimplify and say, well, that looks easy. Just do that. But at the same time, I think a lot of people feel like if you start with that, maybe we don't end up with as much heat, as much tension. Give me your sense for how you train in de-escalation, what it looks like, common techniques, what you want departments thinking about.
Absolutely. So, and that's a great point, because one of the core concepts we talk about and apply to our training is reverse engineering. And oftentimes people will look at that sort of a scenario, and that was fantastic. It turned out wonderfully and absolutely was a great demonstration of how things can go given the right circumstances and the motivation and empathy and some of the other things you were mentioning. But we have to look at it and say, if we look at what we call the crisis moment or the bang moment, if you will, where there is the violence occurring, and we rewind the scenario, we teach in one of the aspects we talk about is just rewinding the scenario by 10 to 15 seconds and saying, okay, if the bang moment is where a punch is thrown or some sort of assault occurs or the actual intervention by law enforcement, if we rewind that 10 to 15 seconds, what happened then? And then continue to rewind back to where we can always find an opportunity to intervene in a way that is based on verbal de-escalation. Now, one of the very strong pieces as well is that we cannot put, whether it's officers or other first responders, the training that they get cannot, put them in a position where they are now unsafe. We have to create an environment where everyone in the situation can have the right to basic physical safety. And if my safety is being jeopardized as an officer, I'm very limited in my ability to verbally talk someone down. In this example you gave earlier of the individual that had the knife and the officer going up, that's a really, really tough scenario to look at outside and say, well, what were the contributing factors? Because there's much tactical training, and I was a defensive tactics instructor for law enforcement as well, that would truly tell an officer to never approach and get within, 21 foot or 32 feet of an armed individual because of data and research by the Force Science Institute that shows how dangerous that can be. But we have to look at the entire process, and that's where we say, well, what were the other contributing factors? Just like you're mentioning, what was the training that officer had, and was he given the tools to use in a situation that is escalating, that where they understand how body language can surely severely escalate or de-escalate a situation, the tone of voice, the words that they use, choice speech, what are the words that they're using in that situation that are potentially confrontational versus more of a cooperative approach. We teach, one of the tools we teach, which really gets a lot of favorable response from law enforcement, especially, we call it the five steps to de-escalation. And in these five steps, while there is never any guaranteed solution, one of the very first components of the five steps we say is, what's in it for me? And this is where the individual that is responding has to determine what is it, what's in it for them to resolve this scenario successfully and effectively without obviously escalating to a higher level of force. What is the reason why they should try? What do they have to gain from doing that? And if you truly dig into this, this has everything to do with the mindset and the motivation, if you will, of that responder. And I think a lot of traditional training focuses very heavily on, well, what is the mental illness? What's the diagnosis? What's going on with the individual in crisis, when truly it needs to be about what is actually going on inside of the individual that's responding? Because if I'm showing up to a situation and I haven't been taught about, you know, another quote we use is that the EQ equals IQ. The higher the emotional intelligence of the responder, the more intelligent the response. And understanding, and, you know, I don't know many law enforcement training agencies that actually teach enough about emotional intelligence, mm-hmm. which if we get into that, EQ has to do with self-awareness, self-regulation. You know, as mentioned, what is my motivation? Do I have the empathy and the social skill to be able to deploy these quote-unquote techniques that I've been taught?
Well,
and so I think.
Well, just let me jump in here because I'm very curious about this, given some of the conclusions that the harshest critics of American policing are making right now. I'll get to that in just a second. I'll remind our listeners, we're talking to Brendan King, the CEO and founder of the Crisis Consultant Group in Virginia, and Brendan's got Rochester roots and his organization. You can understand why they may be in demand among police departments across the country. There's a lot of talk about de-escalation, and that's what Crisis Consultant Group does. They work with de-escalation, not just among police, but certainly with police departments that want that kind of training. And if you've got questions or comments, listeners, you can interact with the program multiple ways this hour. It's 844-295-TALK. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And you can email the program connections@wxxi.org. Brendan, the harshest critics have argued recently that too often policing recruits and sort of attracts, you know, whether the critics would use the phrase toxically masculine or, you know, people who are generally very aggressive, usually men, but not always. And again, that's a broad brush comment, but I am curious to know if what you are talking about is everyone trainable in this? I mean, in other words, let's say you take some of the least sort of emotionally giving people, the people who tend to view things in a little bit more, maybe a different way than what we're talking about here. Can you train people enough in emotional intelligence and in de-escalation? Do you view everyone in every department as trainable?
That's a great, great question. You know, in my experience, over 15 years of training across the country and in a myriad of organizations, there are surely some personality and character traits that you want to look for and identify as early on as possible, because there are individuals that I do believe are not. I would say that in this topic are just simply not going to be trainable. And while that is not a huge number, I do believe that it is there and it does exist. And so there is no magic answer. And this is I was talking with one of my teammates today, and we were talking about the importance of training in an academy where when we've gone through, and years ago when we went through the academy, you surely have role play scenarios that are presented to you as an officer that you have to respond to, where they, you know, the instructors lay out this scenario ahead of time and they are looking for specific reactions. But we have not heard, and I'm sure it probably does exist, but has not seen it in a large scale, where there are scenarios that don't just cover a potential crisis and how to de-escalate, but also how to actually, we expect a recruit to know that, hey, if I see a coworker that is maybe unintentionally escalating the situation, or is maybe one of those people, as we're talking about, that just don't have this ability to connect and have a rapport and a relationship with the individual they're dealing with, and they're more of maybe that high level, I hate to, you know, as you said, broad brush, but the alpha kind of, you know,
sure.
They got beat up a lot in high school and they're just yep. looking to, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, that exists. That do we actually create scenarios that show another cadet how to remove successfully their coworker that may be unintentionally escalating the situation? And so, you know, I think that comment is correct, and that feeling is that there are individuals that truly may not be the right fit, just like, you know, nearly every type of position. But we do need, as law enforcement officers, to hold ourselves to the higher standard. We had some comments come in a couple days ago on one of our social media channels, and you know, the question is, well, you know, de-escalation is one thing, but we need to get society to calm down and stop acting aggressive. And I just kind of hear that, and I'm like, well, so where do we want to argue over, where do we put the blame, right? We're never going to get this resolved. Truly, we have to accept the fact that, you know, if I step into law enforcement, I'm doing so, and many of us that step into that are, I would say, you know, 90 to 95% of us when we join, it is truly because we want to help our fellow man. And often we have that protector and that mindset of being someone that wants to maybe help, being the underdog and wants to help those in need. And over a period of time, depending on what the exposure is, where they work, of course, what the training is, that we lose touch with those initial feelings and desires that we had when we started the job. And we lose that connection to the why. And, you know, I was reading this morning, the chiefs of police, they, in one of their articles, they put out that the what's the definition of de-escalation? And one of the kind of commonly held statements would be, you know, and I'll summarize here, but taking action and communicating verbally or non-verbally to stabilize and create, remove the immediacy of the threat and try to create more time and options so resources can be resolved on to resolve the situation. Well, our definition that we teach in our program is basically aligned within our philosophy, demonstrating genuine care, concern, and compassion combined with the willingness and desire to help individuals successfully navigate through crisis. So on one hand, you have a very strategic and tactical answer that makes sense when you read it in a book. But if you truly want, I believe, to train individuals to be able to de-escalate, then we have to get away from this more tactical even discussion and say, hey, this is about human dignity and respect.
All right,
and
so,
teaching that and training and getting connected to that is truly the key.
So make sure that I'm mm-hmm. I'm hearing you correctly, that yes, there may be some who are just not the right fit for policing. That does exist, and that's a problem, but that's not necessarily most, and that most officers are trainable about emotional intelligence. De-escalation techniques can be learned, and there's even a scenario where it's not just about the officer themselves learning about how to de-escalate, you know, their own feeling or somebody else, but may see a colleague who is intentionally or unintentionally escalating and learning how to sort of work in and navigate those moments. Is that fair? Is that a good assessment?
Absolutely.
Okay.
100%.
All right. So the incident that comes to mind immediately for me, and I'm not sure it's a perfect example, but one that comes up to me was the incident in Buffalo where, you know, you've got a 75-year-old gentleman who was apparently bringing, it looked like, a helmet back to police. And, you know, one of the officers, of course, shoves him. He falls backwards, hit his head. I think we've all seen the video. He was bleeding mm-hmm. out on the sidewalk. And one of the officers looked ready to kind of check on him. And then one of his colleagues kind of grabbed him and pulled him aside and said, you know, kind of keep walking. And they all kind of left him there. And look, I'm always very careful not to try to get inside anybody's head or heart, because, you know, I don't necessarily think at that moment that the police officer wanted that guy falling on the street and hitting his head and bleeding out.
Sure.
But I am curious why in that moment, once that happens and things escalate to the point where the guy goes down, he's an older gentleman, there's blood on the street, why when one officer begins to show interest or compassion or concern, the others go the other way. They pulled them out of doing that and said, like, leave them, you know, as opposed to, hey, that got a little out of hand. You know, it kind of went the opposite direction that obviously I would hope it goes. What's that moment supposed to look like if de-escalation training has been successful?
Well, you know, so that's a great question. And I, like you, cannot get into the mind of the officers in that moment. But if we look at, if we go back to the discussion about the context and scenario, and we say, okay, what was the scenario there? They have an individual that, yes, and, you know, not being there, I'm only speaking from the videos of that incident and seeing it from the outside. But we see, as you've explained, a gentleman who walks forward. Now, you know, difficult part about video is we usually only see the part that makes it to, you know, the highlight reel. We don't know what was said prior exactly. What was his intention? Had they already explained, you know, back off, and people are coming towards them. So in one sense, you say, well, now we're dealing with the potential of a risk of safety. And again, it's very easy to see it and go, oh, well, you know, the gentleman was older and, you know, what on earth happened? And I agree, it does not look good. And in that moment, when the officers moved up, one of the things from a tactical perspective, and even a what they call CDU, Civil Disturbance Unit tactics, is the front line moves ahead. And what they have is an arrest team that is following behind that front line, if you will. And they are actually the ones that are expected to render aid. So you have there, and this is a really great, it's actually a really good example. You have a visual demonstration of something that we, to our hearts, we go, oh my gosh, this absolutely is a terrible thing to witness. And we see that happen. But on the other side, there is a tactic there that it may be that front line was grabbing the other officer to say, hey, that's not for us. We need to continue the wall moving forward, if you will. But this, to me, is part of this, I'd say, the myopic view of de-escalation, where we're talking now about what could have been different in that quote-unquote bang moment, when really it's a bigger picture where if we reverse engineer all the way back minutes or hours or essentially, you know, now we're going back to the academy and training, how do we deal with individuals day to day, and how do we respond to escalated behavior? That's where we find the solutions, through the training, that in the moment that it's happening, it's really easy to just try and quarterback it and say, oh, well, you know, they shouldn't have pushed that guy, or they shouldn't have, well, I understand that. And trust me, I'm not saying, again, that was very difficult to watch. And I am sure that the officer never intended for this gentleman to be injured. I believe that with my heart. But in that moment, tactics now move to the front, whereas the emotional rapport building or communication, obviously that time, there was no time to do that, or none was taken. But that is something that should have happened, obviously, you know, in the bigger picture, early on, just like you were mentioning, where maybe some of the police leadership was able to talk to the group that was formed and maybe establish some level of cooperation so that the incident would never even have escalated to that point.
Let me get Tony in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Tony.
Hey there. I just wanted to add a little bit to this conversation. I was in the military for 23 years, and I've gone through riot control training. And so the way that it works is there's a front line of officers or whoever with, you know, the shields and so on, and they're yelling, get back, get back. And the system is, and right behind them is supervisors or somebody who has radio contact. If somebody were to breach that line, the people in front are ordered, and that's their job, is to keep going forward. And then the person right behind will take care of whatever happens to that person. If you look at that film, what happened was the guy knelt down to help the person that was pushed over. He was, by the supervisor, picked up and put back in front where he should have been. And immediately that supervisor radioed for somebody to come take care of that person. Now, you don't see that part in the end. And this is one of the things that bothers me most about all these viral videos is you don't get the whole story. You don't see the whole thing. So to characterize that officer who was stopped as being somehow, I don't know how to really characterize it. He was doing his job. Both the supervisor was correcting the guy in the front line, because they can't have that line breached. It has to be solid.
Yeah. Tony, can I ask a quick follow-up here, and then I'll kick it back to Brendan, if you don't mind?
Sure.
So I hear the point you're making, and part of the point you're making is the public doesn't understand what the training looks like and why the front line may move on past someone who's literally bleeding on the sidewalk and someone else is going to jump in. And so I take that point. But the next day, when 57 members of that unit resigned from the unit in protest of the suspension of the two officers involved, I think what they probably should have done, call a news conference, put out a statement and say, look, we're heated because we're defending our guys, because you don't get why they did what they did. And we want to tell you, we are trained in de-escalation. We don't want to get to that point, but we also would never leave someone bleeding on the street, and here's what happened. As opposed to just, well, you know, to heck with you people in the public who are upset with that video. That video was upsetting to everybody. And I think that there were failures at different levels, and I think the communication after the event, I'm with you that maybe that we don't know all of the training or all of the details, but I think you got to work hard to communicate right now. I think the public needs good communication from police.
Evan, I totally agree with that point. However, as a soldier and as a person who understands rank and authority and such, I'm the front guy in that line. I'm not allowed to talk.
Yeah. I hear that.
I can't. You know. Yeah. Sure. Maybe they should have made a news cut, but they were in no position, and they would have.
Then their superior should have. Somebody should have.
That's right.
Yeah.
Correct. Somebody should. I'm with you there, but you can't blame those guys in the front line. The guys that got fired or whatever. They were just doing their job. The reason they got fired or suspended, whatever it was, is because it was public relations. They were trying to cover themselves. The leadership was trying to make it so that it didn't escalate further.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. I don't like it when things get characterized like that. It hurts me personally because I've been in those situations. And the guys on the front line, they do care about people getting hurt. They don't want to hurt people. And so I don't know. I guess I said what I wanted to say.
I'm glad you called, Tony, and I appreciate it. And I'll turn it back over to Brendan King, the CEO and founder of the Crisis Consultant Group. Go ahead, Brendan.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. It's a great point. And I think, you know, I was, as he was talking, I was thinking about the biggest, and your follow-up, the biggest failure in communication, and I forget who his quote it was, but it is believing that it's actually occurred. And I think it is so true that there's damage control, if you will, that could be done in many of these incidences that is not getting done. And there, you know, there's a great organization out there, the Force Science Institute, and they do a lot of very just highly regarded research on tactical situations and use of force scenarios and research to study how quickly the body moves, how the brain responds in crisis, and all very in-depth information. And unless you are actually, you know, spending time to research some of those findings, you don't understand and don't realize. For example, you know, when I was on the SWAT team for many years, I was trained as a sniper, police sniper, and one of the aspects that we, when we went through the training, they talk about that they did studies that show if an individual is holding a gun down by their waist and, you know, just verbally threatening, hey, I'm going to shoot you or what have you, and an officer is standing there with a weapon pointed at the individual with their finger on the trigger, that it is, you will be faster to pull your gun up from your side as the bad guy, essentially, and point it in the officer direction and squeeze the trigger faster than an officer will be able to get you'll be more successful in getting that shot off towards the officer than an officer actually squeezing the trigger in that moment. And I can tell you the very first time I heard that, I thought, I can't believe that. And sadly, the research demonstrates this, but that information is not out there in the general.
But why? That doesn't make sense to me either. Why, if that's true, why is that true? That doesn't make sense.
Sure. So there's some pieces that you know, some primal parts of your brain that in the most basic of terms, action is always faster than reaction. That literally something has to happen first. So if we say, well, I've got my weapon pointed at this gentleman, he's threatening to shoot me. When his brain decides to move forward in that aggressive manner and bring that gun up, we are talking hundreds of a second. And in order for me to take offensive action, my brain has to see the threat occurring, and I have to then tell my brain and my hand to complete that act of squeezing the trigger, aiming, and taking that shot. And it just as you're saying, it's very much, when you first hear it, you're thinking, there's no way, but there's actual a lot of research and science that went into that study and many others that talk about use of force and explain how these things happen. And without, you know, looking at that data, we're left to think, oh, well, the cop should have just shot him in the kneecap. And, you know, those sorts of comments come out and you hear people thinking that it should have just been handled this way. And again, I think that's where we get hung up on the what happened in the bang moment, instead of going back like this conversation started and saying, what can we do in training to better prepare, and even in hiring practices, making sure that we are hiring the right individuals that we know have the characteristics of those individuals we want out there doing the best job and quite often the job that they want to do out there for the general public.
After our only break of the hour, we're going to come back with Brendan King, and we're going to talk about the 5 steps to de-escalation that they teach at the Crisis Consultant Group. And if you missed it earlier this hour, Brendan has got Rochester roots, lives in Virginia, had years in law enforcement and the military, and now been working since 2004 as the CEO and founder of the Crisis Consultant Group. They don't only work with police departments. They've got a wide range of clients, but for obvious reasons, the emphasis right now is on their work with policing. And we're talking about what de-escalation works with, what the goal is, how it unfolds when it is happening properly, and how you train people, and whether everybody's trainable in that. Let's get our only break of the hour. We'll also have some more of your feedback coming up. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, we've heard from civil rights organizers. We've heard from city council. We've heard from the Rochester Police Locust Club. And now, Tuesday, we hear from leaders in community organizations and faith groups. What do they want when it comes to police reform? Reverend Lewis Stewart, among others, joins us. We'll talk about what they think the demands ought to be on Tuesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Brendan King, my guest for the hour, the founder of the Crisis Consultant Group. And I want to ask you about these steps, Brendan, and not to be glib, we're going to keep our focus on policing, understandably where it belongs, but I kind of think that everybody could benefit from knowing at least a little bit about de-escalation techniques, because we've all been in situations where, whether it's a spouse, a friend, a work situation, your temperature's rising in a way that doesn't feel comfortable. You're not going in a direction you want to be. Maybe you say something that you regret later. We'd all probably like to be able to, in moments, do a better job of de-escalating, to say nothing of the fact that we need a police force in this country that is well-trained with de-escalation and understands what that truly means when lives are on the line. So tell me about 5 steps.
Sure. So the 5 steps was a tool that actually, there's a little bit of a story behind it, that years ago when I was working in law enforcement, I got a call for a individual who folks were driving by and saw what they believed to be a motor vehicle accident. The vehicle was over the embankment, and a guy had actually tried to jump into another car to drive away. So they could see that he was drunk and intoxicated and called. So I was headed up to this location. And as I arrived, and to give you the short version, but as I arrived, I saw this gentleman standing in the road. I could see the headlights off over the embankment. I could very quickly see that this was not going to necessarily be the most calm situation. And I stepped out of the vehicle. I opened the car door, and I stepped out. And before I was even able to say much of anything at all, the individual pointed in my direction, screamed at the top of his lungs, F you, pig. And in that moment, I thought, okay. So one mode of thought immediately goes, well, obviously this individual is escalated and is intoxicated. I could see just by his staggering and his behavior. But in that moment, if we jump to use of force, we would say, well, now I see this verbal threat, this challenge. This is very, you know, potentially an opportunity to go to a taser or a high level of force in that situation based on the behavior. But what was part of this equation was what I mentioned earlier was the first step in the five steps, which is establishing what's in it for me. When the call came out over the radio, it was later in the shift, and I knew that I was headed towards this isolated part of the county that I worked in. And I knew that it could be quite dangerous if I didn't de-escalate whatever this situation was as effectively as possible. So my mindset was already in a mode of how can I make sure this goes as smoothly as possible? And quite frankly, as a cop working, you know, almost 2 a.m, you're hoping that maybe the caller got it wrong, that this wasn't somebody who was drunk, that maybe they were just avoiding a deer and you'll just get a tow truck and they'll be on their way, because doing a DWI arrest or, you know, driving while intoxicated, that can easily take hours. And so the first step was I had to have the right mindset. So the first step is what's in it for me. The second one is demonstrate I'm not a threat. And this can be, as you're talking about, whether or not this is in a corporate environment, this is even in a personal relationship. But when we feel as though the person we're dealing with is either a psychological threat or emotionally threatening to us, we are often likely to escalate. So is there something I can do either non-verbally or verbally through my body language and different words that I say that can demonstrate to this person, hey, I'm not here to be a threat to you? So what happened was, and I saw this when I went back over the video to watch what had happened, and without truly thinking about this, I had taken my hand and put it over my badge and put my hand towards, kind of outstretched towards the gentleman. I said, whoa, 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 hold on a second, man. And I pointed down to his car and I said, man, is that your car down there? And in this moment, obviously my reaction to him was not the one that he was initially expecting. And as I said that, I could see the type of car. It was that Camaro that came out a few years ago, that Chevrolet with yellow and black stripes that looked like the Transformers, a really neat vehicle, right? And I looked down and I said, whoa, 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 hold on, man. I said, is that that new Camaro, man? Man, that thing is beautiful. What happened? Did a deer jump out or something? And in that moment, this gentleman who is surely expecting me to have a more negative or aggressive response, I'm thinking in his mind, he probably thought, oh, dumb rookie, doesn't know that I've been drinking. You know, hey, he's going to help me get my car out. So what I did was step three, which was find an in. And this was an immediate identification of similarities. And we can apply that concept to really any interaction that we're having with someone, that while you and I may be talking and I see that you're escalated about a particular thing, before we even get into the whether your frame of reference is correct or incorrect, what I have to do is establish an in and build some sort of rapport. And one of the things that often I would ask when I was working, even in the hospitals, is I'd ask an individual, I'd say, hey, are you willing to let me try to help you? Are you willing to let me try to help you with this? Because it truly, when you're asking someone who's in crisis, you know, are you willing to let me? So I'm asking, not telling, and I'm truly, you know, offering up, hey, I'm someone who I believe I can help you get through this. Are you willing to let me do that? So I'm also putting some ownership on the individual that I'm dealing with and talking to, that they need to give me that space to do that. So that's that third step, finding in. The fourth step is what we say, meet a need. So in that situation, Maslow's hierarchy, years ago, a famous psychologist, he came up with this hierarchy of needs that as human beings we all have. And some of the basics, most fundamental levels are you know, physical safety needs and physiological needs, you know, food, water, and shelter. And next comes physical safety. And then moving up this pyramid, we get to a place where all of us have certain needs in the moment. And if I can create a solution in that moment to satisfy a need that you have. Now, going back to the scenario, as I mentioned to this guy about his car down in the ditch, I said, hey, you know, man, beautiful car. And he's looking at me going, oh, yeah, that is the car. And I said, well, man, did you call a tow truck already? Did you get a record out here? And he's thinking to himself, oh my gosh, this cop's going to help me get my vehicle out. Now I knew I still had to deal with the fact that he was intoxicated, but in that moment I went to meet a need. And so now I have this connection with this individual that is a solution to this known need that he has and that I can help with. And lastly, now, while we're standing there, as the minutes go on, he had immediately de-escalated because, of course, I'm not providing any confrontation, if you will, to him. And in that moment, I say, hey, you know, Mr. Smith, you know, how you doing? I'm just coming up here tonight. You know, that's a really great car. And we're just kind of making small talk. I said, here's the thing, man. You know, this is kind of interesting. There was a call. The reason why I'm here is some folks called and, man, you know, you don't truly seem intoxicated to me, but I'm a little concerned that, you know, they thought you were drunk. And see that red light back there on my camera, on my vehicle? That's a camera right there. And I have to make sure that I tell my supervisor, you know, I did my job. So are you willing to work with me a little bit? You know, have you had anything to drink tonight? And would you be willing to run through these tests with me? And in that moment, because I've taken the time of establishing the right mindset, what's in it for me, demonstrating I wasn't a threat, finding that in, and trying to meet a need that he has, he was much more willing to comply and go along with it. Now, sure enough, he was intoxicated heavily. But by the time I got to the handcuff, he was calm and actually thanking me for arresting him. And there are many police officers out there that are doing a phenomenal, phenomenal job, the majority. And they will tell you stories that they've had people actually thanking them at times where they've place them in the cuffs, because they realize that in that moment they were treated with dignity and respect. And while the officer had a job to do, which may have not been the desired outcome for the individual, you know, when they set out meeting law enforcement, in the end, what won out was, you know, that dignity and respect and you know, fair treatment. So those five steps are an effective tool to use in many different types of crisis.
Let me get another phone call. This is Ted in Rochester. Go ahead, Ted.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Mr. King. Thank you for coming on today and talking about your training. I had a couple of comments here. Number one, Forest Science Institute, I find that their methodology and data is questionable. Our police union was spent $70,000 to train officers, and our council members want to spend another $20,000 to train captains. And there was outcry because, you know, this was a shoot first and, you know, legitimate the shooting later kind of organization. And so city council withdrew that money. I have a friend of mine is a former Oakland police officer, and he, you know, was with some of his people at a Forest Science Institute training. And, you know, it was around the Walter Scott incident. And the whole first day, 8 hours, the trainers tried to convince the police officers over there engaging in this training that Mr. Scott was at fault. And, you know, my friend told his fellow officers that they could leave and not come back. And it was a 4-day train because he said, this is ridiculous. So I guess that's anecdotal, but I just really question it. Secondly, this notion that we should expect officers to handle all situations isn't fair. I was struck by something you said at the beginning, which was about your experience in mental health, where you were trained in verbal de-escalation, some holds that were not injurious but could calm someone down, and that you had a whole body of people around you, professionals, to step in if needed to help de-escalate those situations. And it seems to me that defunding the police and reallocating that money to the professionals that can handle the mental health calls, that could handle substance abuse and addiction issues, with the police available to be called at their discretion, is maybe a better way to go forward than to, again, not that the police officers shouldn't get de-escalation training, but that de-escalation training, to me, it just feels too little too late at this point.
All right. Thank you, Ted. And we're done about 90 seconds. Go ahead, Brendan King.
Sure. So I think great point. So the reality of having other well-trained individuals available is absolutely not something that I would say is a bad thing, right? The more we can truly have individuals that are prepared. But what I would caution is this, is while on the surface we say, well, sending out, let's say, a mental health practitioner, which has been, you know, that's in effect in many jurisdictions where they bring what's called a CIT, crisis intervention team training, and they bring these mental health professionals out. They have spent considerable amount of time working with the departments so that they recognize clearly that there are, and if you talk to many of those folks that do that, that are in the mental health community, they recognize that there are certain situations that the time that it takes to get that social worker out to the scene, you simply don't have it, or that when someone escalates to the point of physical violence, let's say I'm being sent there as a mental health professional, and maybe let's just say law enforcement is not on the scene, and instead I get called to go there, where is the time and how is that individual who is not prepared to physically be able to handle someone who is threatening and violent and aggressive, where what do we do in between? So if the question is, how do we get them to work together better, then to me, defunding is not necessarily the way to go. But reallocating to developing these partnerships can be a great solution.
Brendan King's the CEO and founder of the Crisis Consultant Group. Where are you online if people want to learn more about this approach, Brendan?
Absolutely. So two places, just crisisconsultantgroup.com or calmeverystorm.com.
Thank you for making the time. We appreciate it. These are important conversations in every department and every community, and we appreciate that, Brendan.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Brendan King from the Crisis Consultant Group, talking de-escalation among American police. I hope you're a member of member-supported public radio, and we're so grateful that you listen every day. I want to thank the whole team here. Rob Braden is the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we will talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.